Welcome to the podcast of Motorweek, television's original automotive magazine. Here's your Motorweek podcast host, John Davis.
And welcome to Motorweek podcast number 85. I am John Davis, and joining me around the table in Studio C today is producer, writer, and two-wheeling reporter Brian Robinson.
What's up, John?
And road test producer Ben Davis.
Hey.
Our writer Patrick Lucas.
I'm here.
And our assistant producer Greg Carlos.
Good to be here.
Gosh,
again.
We got all four of you guys today. I'm honored. I'm awestruck. And we've got a lot of awesome cars to talk about today. We'll do our lightning round. We'll also have our Motorweek mailbag. But we're going to go down a list of some pretty interesting vehicles that have come our way. And more recently, we're going to look at the Mini Cooper S Paceman. We'll talk about the new diesel effort on the Chevrolet Cruze, what's going on with the Jeep Grand Cherokee, i.e. the diesel and the 8-speed transmission, and a new player, the Kia Cadenza. But we'll start with the Mini Cooper. We had a Mini Cooper S Paceman in recently. For those of you that cannot keep track of all the iterations of Mini Coopers, this is basically the Countryman, which is their five-door
crossover,
thank you. And it's a three-door version of it. Those of you as old as I am remember when three-door SUVs used to be very common. They aren't anymore. But it's a niche player. And, guys, you had a chance to drive the Countryman a while back, and now we've had the Paceman. Likes, dislikes, comparison, who does it suit? Have a go.
Well, as you mentioned, it's basically just a two-door version of the Countryman, but it doesn't have the Countryman's kind of off-road stance. It's got, like, more of a sport suspension on it.
So you write off, you think it's sportier?
Well, you would think so, but it didn't feel like it driving it. Just the looks of it, I think it's much sportier. But, it's the bigger Minis aren't nearly as fun as the smaller Minis. I mean, they're close, but backseat room was surprisingly okay, but not a lot of storage space. I don't know. It seemed awful pricey for what you were getting. That's my take.
Patrick? I didn't find it particularly sporty. I found it weird kind of inside. It is a small car, but it feels very small, and there's like a weird seating position. I noticed that like side mirrors are set low, like under the belt line, so like when you adjust them you can only see out of about half of them. If you go real high up, then you can't see out of the rear view mirror up top, and so I found a lot of problems with getting comfortable, and then once I did it, I mean, I didn't find it particularly exciting.
Let me ask the other two guys here this question. This is for lack of a better word, they're calling it a compact crossover, but, you know, we're now getting down to almost mini-size crossovers, and they're not the only one, the Buick Encore, and there's some others coming out. Is there a market for these? I mean, this probably the Paceman is as good an example as we're going to see. Are they useful? I mean, they're selling okay, but... You know, is there a big market for this kind of small vehicle?
I'm sure there is. I mean, I might not be in that market, but
just because you're well over 6 foot tall,
yeah.
your head would stick out the sunroof,
right?
It's like you create the vehicle, and then I feel like they're worrying about the market after the fact. Almost, it's not much. You don't have many benefits over, like, say, a compact car, other than you can get all-wheel drive in a lot of these vehicles. And maybe it's kind of taken the place of the station wagon.
Yeah, I mean, I know people like to, I guess, ride a little bit higher, like specifically women, I think. I know my mom personally got into an SUV for the first time, and she's never looked back. But now my dad's saying, you know, you're going to need some more gas mileage. And she doesn't want to get out of that big SUV. So this might be a little bit of a compromise, I guess, for people who still want to feel like they're driving somewhat of an SUV.
And sit tall.
And it's just, I guess it's more of a subconscious thing. You just feel a little bit better when you're driving in something that's labeled an SUV. But 10 years ago, we would never really consider that an SUV.
Yeah, I've got a Mini Cooper Coupe, one of the 2002 models. So I liked that package. So when I got into the Paceman, I was kind of hoping that I would feel like I was in just a slightly bigger rendition. And actually, I felt like I was in a much bigger rendition, and it didn't handle as well. So, yeah, the all-wheel drive seems to be the biggest thing you can say about it.
Well, you have to step up to Cooper S to get the all-wheel drive. You can't get all-wheel drive on the base Cooper.
Which makes it pretty pricey.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess we give it it's okay, but we're not thrilled about it when it comes to the Cooper S. I think we were surprised how it didn't feel very sporty on the road, but when it got on the track, it actually performed extremely well.
Oh, yeah, super responsive steering. That's one thing I remember.
So that may throw people. The first impression is not as sporty as it looks, but it did do extremely well in our test facility.
I think actually the before we end it, mm-hmm. the color actually makes a huge difference because we had that the blue Veloster, or I call it a Veloster because I think it looks a little bit like, it looks like a chunky Veloster to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, the color does make a difference in how sporty the car actually looks. If you get a blue one, it's
a dark
almost
blue
like a
too.
Almost like a toy, huh?
Oh, that wasn't necessarily
like
real
a purpley,
dark blue.
It was like a purpley blue. Was,
are you saying lighter colors?
Yeah, color blue made it look almost like a toy. And then you get a black in with black wheels, and it does look a little bit sporty.
Well, that makes sense.
So, yeah.
And you get to choose a lot of color choices with a Mini. Okay, Chevrolet Cruze diesel. Patrick, you went on the first drive to that.
I did.
This is a big deal, and I'll just get this out of the way. Back in the late 70s and early 80s, when we were worried about the Arab oil embargo that had just happened, GM came out with some diesels, big and small. They were converted gas engines. They were problem prone. They were smelly. They pretty much killed the appetite for diesel cars in America. Now Chevrolet's dipping their toe back in the water, as are other brands. And the Cruze diesel's got some pretty decent reviews so far. But Patrick, you drove it. What'd you think?
I liked it. I like what they're doing. I like that they're trying diesel again. The Cruze platform is not a very exciting car to put a diesel engine into.
So you wouldn't say that this is a true competitor to a Jetta TDI?
I did find it. I mean, they were really going after the Jetta TDI. They're hammering that point home that this was better. And the numbers are better.
Yeah.
The numbers are better. 151 horsepower, 200
huge amount of torque.
264, 264.
Better gas, better fuel economy.
I think it's 717 mile cruising range. Mm-hmm. But it just doesn't feel as sporty or as refined as a Jetta. It still is very impressive, very fun to drive, and much better than any other Cruze you can get right now.
So on the practical aspects that people would buy a diesel for as far as fuel economy,
right,
range, and so forth,
this is definitely,
it does very well.
Awesome. Great.
Okay. Yeah, I was a little surprised that they would spend so much time going after the Jetta TDI. But then again, that's the only other game
that's
in town.
Yeah, that's true.
And this is a clean diesel. It meets all the U.S. and foreign standards. And actually, to my knowledge, it's one of the first four cylinders that actually uses urea injection.
Whoa!
Because mostly that's been held off for the six cylinders.
I obviously don't know all the tech because mm-hmm. they put a ton of work into it, but I mean, this is something ridiculous. Like, the emissions are almost like 100%, like,
very, very, very,
very, very
low.
Clean. I don't know exactly.
Extremely
so
clean.
It's incredibly environmentally friendly, which I know a lot of people are
What's
are
the
into.
Price premium going to be? Do we know yet? Or
I think it.
That's where it comes down
it
to.
It starts at 25, which is it's a little bit less than the Jetta TDI.
It's a little more expensive than the Cruze Eco.
Right.
Yeah, or maybe it is more expensive than the Cruze Eco.
See how the resale holds out, because Jetta TDIs have tremendous resale still to
exactly.
this day.
I really just don't know how it's going to sell, though.
I'm encouraged by it, and I think it says that with all the new fuel economy standards coming, we're going to see more diesels. We know Mazda's getting ready to do a couple of diesels, including one in the six. So it's good they're doing it. You still have a problem with the cost of entry, the premium there, and the cost of fuel. So even though you're getting better fuel economy, is it enough to offset the extra 40 cents or so a gallon? I guess in some cases
My guess is the average Cruze buyer is looking to get out of the dealership as cheaply as possible.
Yeah.
I'm not sure they're going to plunk down extra money for the diesel.
And GM hasn't put any real sales targets on it. They're doing it to show they can do it and basically do a clean diesel. And
Is it just the one trans that they're offering? I think Jetta still offers a manual trans.
The
PSG.
Is just the six-speed automatic.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Did it feel like it had that much power off the line?
Straight off the line, it kind of does. You feel it more passing on the highway, maybe going, exiting some corners. The transmission kind of still lags behind a little bit, kind of hinders it.
So there's no manual for this? Is there?
I want to say no.
I don't believe there is.
I'd be shocked if there was.
Because that's one of the big advantages of the TDI. Yeah,
exactly. Plus, you could get much better fuel economy.
Yeah. Okay, we beat that one up pretty good. Cruise diesel, interesting vehicle, maybe a little ahead of its time, but it's good to see them doing it. Let's go on to another diesel, the Jeep Grand Cherokee diesel. This is a 3-liter turbocharged V6 diesel, and it comes with a lot of other changes to the Grand Cherokee for 14, and we can all talk about that as well. I know most of you have not driven the diesel. I have driven the diesel. But you all have driven the 3.6 V6 gas engine with the new 8-speed transmission. So let's actually talk about that first, since that's the one that most people are going to buy. Your impressions versus the long-term that we had that had the 6-speed, is the 14 with the 8-speed automatic that much different?
Yeah, it definitely felt a little quicker off the line. A little smoother, shifts came quicker, but there's a lot more
just
of them.
A lot of, yeah.
Like all the 8-speeds, it's just in a hurry to get to the top.
Exactly,
gear.
Yeah. And then once you're cruising an eighth, which is extremely fast because you're right up to eighth, it seems like it kind of stumbles getting back into seventh and sixth when you're trying to pass or
do you think that's
like
just
that.
The torque converter unlocking? Or
It's hard to say.
Yeah.
Too much hunting, kind of.
Yeah, exactly.
Really jump in there real quick.
So I expect that. Yeah, the upshifts are, you know, silky smooth. Just downshifts, I think, was a little clunky. But you know, when you're cruising on the highway in eighth gear, you're getting some pretty decent gas mileage. So that's nice.
What about the overall interior of the vehicle? They've done a lot of changes there. Yay, nay?
The shifter is something I'm not a fan of.
It's not programmed quite right. It's hard to engage a park. There's no feeling park.
Is it that you have to hold it there? Say you're going from drive, you're going to parallel park. You almost have to hold it there to park. Otherwise, it puts you in reverse. I almost got out of the car, and it was still in reverse.
I didn't really notice the problem with it.
Yeah, you guys got to pay attention more.
It's funny that nobody complained about, what did we have in here, an A8 that had that transmission?
Right. I think we had the Chrysler 300's got the same
thing. And the Chrysler 300's got it, It's like, okay.
Yeah, I never noticed the problem.
But everybody sort of said, whoops. I guess it's because we lived with a Grand Cherokee for a year. I like the new, all the changes. I think the interior looks nicer. I don't like the fact they did away with the two-piece tailgate where you could open the glass separately. I know they said nobody used it, but if you put anything on the back of it, like even a trailer, but you know, any kind of a cargo carrier that goes in the hitch that you want to leave back there and not mess with when you want to get into the back area, the cargo area, it was nice to have it. So I'm sorry to see that go away.
Yeah, the TFT screens make a nice touch, too, the bigger screens. And
very nice job on the inside. Okay, diesel. I drove the V6 we had here and then immediately got a chance to drive the diesel. The off-the-line acceleration of the diesel is very similar to how the gas 6 felt. Very energetic, pulled you along. There is some diesel clatter when you first start it, but it's not objectionable. Smooths right out. The only thing, and this is really for people that are not used to turbocharged diesels, because this will be fairly new to buyers that have not tried any of the European SUVs that have diesel power. And when you hit the throttle, there is a bit of a turbo lag or whatever else they've programmed into that throttle. And for an instant or two, there's no reaction. So if you go with a soft push on the pedal, trying to get away from a light gradually, nothing seems to happen for that instant. And then when it catches, it pulls you away in almost a rush. I thought, wow. You know, it really impresses you with that. But on the other hand, people might think that it's a little too powerful right off the line. I think it's something that if you drive it for a half hour, you get used to it. But it was a different experience.
Certainly diesel makes more sense in a Grand Cherokee than a Chevrolet Cruze.
Absolutely. And not only does it get substantially better fuel economy than along with – it has the 8-speed automatic too. Yeah. Better fuel economy than what they had before. It actually gets hugely better fuel economy than the last time they did a diesel.
I remember that.
Matter of fact, the V6 gas does better than that.
I think to get the diesel, you got to spend like $41,000. You got to get it limited, and then add diesel on top of that. So,
and again,
it's pricey.
You know, it's pricey, and you know, do you really need it? So, somebody towing, I think it's an effortless tower. They'll do well with it. But great to see that happening as well. Kia Cadenza. This is a new upscale entry by Kia. It is basically their version, and I use that term loosely, of the Hyundai Azera. It is a large car, although according to Patrick, who was at the press preview, they're not quite sure what to call it, right?
Yeah, they didn't really label it a size. They just kind of labeled competition, and they went all over the place. They were saying Acura TL, Lexus ES, Toyota Avalon. I would compare it. I don't know if they said this, but I would compare it also to the new Impala.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all over the place. It's near, it's mid, full size, somewhere in between there. I don't know.
But wouldn't you agree that it's aimed at the Toyota Avalon?
Probably, yeah. And I don't know if this is going to be Kia's new flagship or not. I know the
Avalon. They're going to come out. They've already announced a car above it.
Is it really luxurious or is it just bigger?
I
saw in the interior.
It's bigger. I would call it near luxury. It's definitely not a luxury car.
The interior looked a lot like the Optima.
It does. And I think I mentioned that in the car keys or whatever. Mm-hmm. If you've been in a Kia recently, we just had the Sorento in and the Optima. It feels very familiar.
So if you've got the big deal, I look at it and say, okay, I like the Optima.
Yeah.
However, if the Optima has any shortfalls, it's probably that if you want to put a big adult like me in the rear seat, it can be a little cramped for long distance. So this has got a couple of extra inches of legroom.
This is your
there.
Car, then.
Yeah, except that, you know, I think it looks more conservative. I mean, it seems to be aimed at an older buyer. Would you agree?
I don't know. I mean, I personally liked it. I don't know what it was about this car, but I had fun driving it. I thought it looked good. I came away very impressed.
But I think it's about 4,000 more starting off than an Avalon. So is it worth that 4,000?
Yeah, that is the issue. And I
it's very well equipped, though. You get nav and everything
else.
Yeah,
it starts at 35,000. Yeah, you get nav. You get, I think, 12, something like that. Speakers,
the nav
sound
is standard,
system. Yep.
Which is not in the Avalon.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I don't know you're going to draw somebody away from a Toyota
Avalon. It is interesting, though, that you've got this brand that a few years ago we said, you know, basically was an entry car level brand. And now they've got this broad range of products, all a little bit more upscale than their Hyundai counterparts. Mm-hmm. And they still put, you know, things like, what, paddle shifters and a decent suspension on it.
Yeah, it was
so
fun.
That European-esque flavor is still there.
Yeah, and their designer who does all the sheet metal came over from Audi a couple of years ago, and he's
Dude,
pumping some fresh designs in there.
Yeah, and they're going to do a big car like the Equus, so stay tuned. I guess they're trying to make themselves more differentiate themselves from Hyundai.
I think they're doing a good job.
Okay, thanks very much for everything, guys, and let's move on now to our lightning round, and our panelists have 2 minutes to debate trending automotive topics. When the time's up, they will hear the bell from our producer, Michelle Parker. Okay, the Chevrolet Malibu is getting in on this quick refresh act that we have already seen the Honda Civic go through, where barely a year and a half or so out of on the market, they've changed it quite a bit. They're doing the mid-cycle refresh really at about a quarter cycle in. The new Malibu gets substantial changes outside and inside. Do you think, in a nutshell, it goes far enough to boost sales and move Malibu from not really one of the primary contenders in the mid-size market, even though it's a competent car? Does it move it up? Is it going to make people look at it and say, well, you know, maybe I'm interested in it rather than a Ford Focus or, of course, a Toyota Camry or a Honda Accord? Okay?
Anytime you splice a car up a little bit and call it all new or whatever, you get a little spike in sales, but I don't think it's going to do a whole lot more. I mean, it's still, at the end of the day, it was what it was before with a fancier face and a little more rear legroom.
I think it's nice that they're adopting the family face now, though. I mean, with all the booming sales ads you see for Impala and stuff like that, people that show up at a dealership, maybe drive the Impala, realize they need something a little smaller. At least it falls in line. It has that look that it didn't have before the refresh. And I think
it's
that's
kind of Camaro-esque style.
Yeah, it looks really tough. Yeah. I like it.
Yeah, I think, like Brian said, I think the initial surge will happen right after the release. And I think once people realize that the Impala is going to have some decent success, or at least I think it will, it's gotten some good press, and they see that the Malibu has kind of adopted some of their cues, suspension cues and other aspects of the car, I think they're gonna like that since the Impala's already out. So
and it'll be a lot more affordable.
Yeah, definitely.
Anything, Pat?
I was going to say, I think it's the right direction. I don't know if it's enough right now, though.
Yeah, it probably isn't, but the very fact that they spent the money do it is pretty amazing. At least General Motors to do something ahead of when it was normally scheduled is pretty much unheard of.
So you can be excited for a Malibu in a couple of years, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, they made a mistake but when they did the new Malibu of putting it on a smaller chassis, in my opinion. And you know, they cut down on rear legroom, where they had basically more than everybody else, and everybody else designed their vehicles to beat them. And so they went backwards. And so now they're trying to regroup some of that. And for whatever reason they did made that decision, I think trying to correct it is a good one.
Yeah, but they did it by I'm going to call overtime. Yeah. They did it by basically carving up the front seats and carving up the back seats and then saying there's more room there.
Yeah.
So that's I haven't been in it yet, but to me, I imagine they're less comfortable.
You know, that's going to be the big question. Did they sacrifice comfort, you know, in the back so you have a little bit more legroom?
Yeah. I don't know.
So if you're in the market for the new Malibu, try it and tell us if you like it. It'll be it'll probably be a few more weeks before we all have a chance to get in it. But what we've seen so far looks promising, but we're not sure it's enough. Okay, finally, our Motor Week mailbag. Remember to submit your questions, and if we choose to answer your question, doesn't that sound snobbish? If we pick your question to be answered, that's just as bad. You want a fabulous Motor Week T-shirt, which is one size fits all. Here we go. Arthur asks, and this is a good question, Arthur. Recently, I had the opportunity to drive a 2010 Mercedes S600. Says, I was completely blown away. Here's my question. How would a V12 engine, which the S600 has, compare with a V8 in terms of longevity, frequency of repair, and cost of repair? I thought that the gas was a little worse than the V8. What is our opinion?
I don't know. Maybe you should bring it in here and let me drive it, and then I would be a little more available. I'm sure – I don't know about longevity. I'm sure it's more costly to repair for sure because there's just a lot less of them out there. But
that's true, yeah. Harder to find parts.
Yeah. I wouldn't say longevity or anything would be an issue. I mean
it's probably going to be a Mercedes or
like any German car. You get over 80,000 miles, you're going to start having problems, right?
Yeah, for sure. And they might show up a little more in a 12-cylinder engine than they would in an 8. Those small problems might be bigger problems.
Patrick?
Well, we were talking about this earlier. I mean, a V12, or I've only driven a W12. So but they have more moving parts, so more opportunity for things to go wrong.
Yeah, pretty much everybody said it. Didn't really leave me anything to say.
Well, sorry, Greg. You know, what do you think about it? Talk to the fuel economy aspect. He says he thinks it's a little bit worse than the V8.
Well, naturally, yeah, a bigger engine is probably going to get worse fuel economy than a V12 is probably going to get worse than a V8. But it also depends on displacement as well. So if you have a V12 that has a smaller displacement than maybe a large V8, then the V8's probably going to get worse fuel economy.
Just a small displacement V12 just sent dollar bill signs where I should get my maintenance.
That usually means really high RPMs. Okay, Arthur, basically, yeah, if you got money to buy it, you probably don't care whether or not it's going to have longevity. We wish you luck with it, though. It is going to be more costly down the road, and it might use a little bit more gas. However, the thrill of driving a V12 is something that everybody should have a chance to do at least once.
It's a confidence booster, that's for sure.
Oh, wow. It's a great motor. Great car. All right. Thank you very much for all of our panelists around the table today. Producer, writer, and two-wheeling reporter Brian Robinson. Our road test producer, Ben Davis. Our writer, Patrick Lucas. And also Greg Carlos, our assistant producer, who works with Ben on all the road tests. And I'd also like to thank the folks that make this possible, our audio engineer, Jim Bigwood, our podcast creator, Bob Mixter, and our producer, Michelle Parker, the lady with the bell. Till next time, I'm John Davis. That's right. A little confidence there in that bell ring. I'm John Davis. Thank you very much for listening to our Motor Week podcast. Be sure to catch Motor Week on your public television station and also on Velocity. Till next time, Thanks very much for joining us at Motor Week.
You've been listening to the podcast of Motor Week, television's original automotive magazine. Motor Week is made possible by rockauto.com. For additional information on podcasts, videos, and showtimes, visit our website at motorweek.org. And watch Motor Week, television's longest-running automotive series, each week on your local PBS station.